Beautiful.
Beautiful.
I feel like this is turning into an ASMR thing.
I've just realized we have but one bottle of 2012 vintage Dom Pérignon, and I've just poured a rather large glass for Mumsy.
She deserves the biggest.
The rest of us will have a tasting pour. Well, well, well.
Well.
If it isn't Brother Liam. Look, we all know why Brother Liam sits in this seat today. It's going to be difficult to talk about, so we might just gloss over it quickly. I will say we have a delightful bottle of French champagne that was gifted to us by someone very special. I would like to thank that person, and I would like to cheers to Nicole.
To Nicole.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Today, while also being the new episode, season 2, Impatient Podcast, episode 1 is also what I guess we can call Nicole's party day. Nicole was adamant, and adamant doesn't seem a strong enough word, that she didn't want a funeral. She wanted a party good enough that she would want to be invited to it, and so Tim and Mumsy and some of Nicole's friends have put that party together, and that's where we're heading after we leave here. So we hope, if you're listening to this live, if that's working, we hope you're having champagne. If you're listening to this after the fact, as in recorded, you should probably go open some champagne.
Definitely.
Right. Welcome.
Welcome.
Should we get straight to what the people want to hear?
Definitely, yes. I have a little list here of questions from the people and what they might want.
From the people.
From straight from the people's mouths.
Let's introduce long-time listener, first-time guest on the Impatient Podcast, Mumsy.
Hello.
It is weird.
Thank you. It's a really good start.
It's a really good welcome.
Nicole and I talked about having you and even young Timothy on the podcast at some stage. I never for a second thought that it would be under these circumstances, but here we are. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
We reached out to people on social media this week and said, is there anything you'd like to ask Mumsy? We got some responses.
Good.
Liam's going to hit you with some now.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know how. There's some heavier questions, and I'm not sure how heavy to start off. I'll start from the top. Was your mother-daughter bond as strong before Nicole was diagnosed?
Yes, categorically. We were always incredibly close, and I think the best illustration that people relate to is that when Nicole finished high school and everybody went off on their year 12 leavers, she and I went to Sydney on the midnight flight and had a weekend in Sydney together because that's what she wanted to do.
I forgot about that. Mm. Yeah, yep, good.
That's what we did.
Resounding yes.
Resounding yes.
The second one here, more of a comment than a question, but I do love it. It's Mumsy should do a cookbook.
I agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah, I agree with that too.
Cooking for chemo. Yeah. And Josh would be able to tell me that as long as it didn't have sugar in it, it was healthy. That's his theory on healthy food.
I feel like if he had a lot of input, it would be a lot of avocado and tuna sushi.
And chocolate ice cream.
And chocolate ice cream.
Although, like, let's be real, Joshua's opinion on a lot of things is fairly strong.
Yes.
And he is the guy that calls this a boring old podcast. So, grain of salt.
He did ask me why he had to go back to his dad this afternoon. And I said that we're doing the boring old podcast. And he just looked at me and burst out laughing. Why do you guys do that boring podcast?
Next one would be, what are your if you have any, coping mechanisms, or it's for all of us actually, what are coping mechanisms that we've used as a family?
Oh, crying. I think it would be a big one, I think, wouldn't it? Sobbing. I think if you like, if you had to kind of, you know, put it in a little bag, I just think it would have to be the closeness that we've always had. So when Nicole died, we all came home and we spent the next, what, 4 or 5 days together?
Yeah.
And we laughed and we cried and we were together and we messaged each other, I don't know, 40, 50 times a day.
Yeah.
So we just, yeah. I think it's just that closeness for us. I don't, you, do you agree? Is that?
Yeah. I mean, I don't, I mean, I think you said crying sort of semi in jest. I think it's usually important.
No, right? I wasn't jesting. I was saying that's a coping mechanism. Yeah. Like that's probably the primary.
That's
a
massive part of the process.
Yeah,
I think,
it is. Yeah.
Just and accepting that.
It's interesting. A wise philosopher said to me last week, I commented that I didn't think that I was coping very well, and he knows who he is, and he said, yes, you are, because you care for this child all the time and you get up and you go to work and you cook meals and you be a mother to your sons and you do all of these things that actually are illustrations of the fact that you're coping. And a terrible thing has happened to all of us and there's an adjustment period and we just have to adjust over time. But that doesn't mean you're not coping. It means that you are coping. You're just very sad.
Yeah. I think that book that was gifted to all of us, I think it's called Coping with Grief. I've posted about it on Instagram. I found it immensely helpful because I feel like it sort of allows you to feel the way you feel and kind of washes away the expectation that you get from others somehow.
I think one of the weirdest things about the whole circumstances that we have found ourselves in, certainly from my personal point of view, is, and they talk about this a lot in that book, that if you talk about death, then it, in inverted commas, will happen.
Mm.
Yeah, so I would certainly say that we were very guilty, is that the right word, as a family of not talking about death at all. And part of that was that, you know, we worked on the plan A and the plan A was that Nicole was going to live and get better and everything was going to be, you know, rosy and wonderful and lovely.
Yeah.
And so that was plan A. There couldn't be a plan B.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think there's a lot to be said for those conversations so that you – I think it was – I don't know, 2 hours before Nicole died that she told us she didn't want a funeral. So it's a good job she kind of got to that at that point because it was kind of an important piece of information that we only got at that very late stage.
Yeah, so. But I think you're right. Like I've thought about this point a lot since the 10th of January. And, I mean, certainly there's people with a better understanding of mental health out there, probably one sitting on the couch behind you that might be able to help explain this. I don't know that we've ever talked about it either, Carly. I don't know, I can't see how it's possible to feel comfortable talking about death in that situation where if you're going like full steam ahead, treatment, we're going to fight this, we're going to win, talking about death is almost accepting that, you know, maybe you might not win. And how do you, I don't know how you do that.
I think that, and it's certainly something that I've really contemplated a lot, I'm not particularly suggesting that people who are dealing with a stage 4 cancer patient should talk about death. I'm saying as humans, we should talk about death more.
Yeah.
Like as people in, I guess in Western society, like I'm 62 years old. Do either one of you have any clue what I want as my death plan? Like you don't have a clue.
Yes, I'm just assuming it involves bats for some reason.
Involves bats.
Yeah, a cave.
Okay.
I'm just assuming.
Yeah, okay.
Like if it were up to me, we would use bats to somehow spread ashes.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what that looks like, but I feel like
I like just based on from what you've said, I think you want just the biggest funeral possible with lots of black. You really strike me as a traditionalist when it comes to
flowers.
Yeah. We need to somehow make it rain.
Yeah,
not in terms of money, but
black
like
umbrellas.
Actual, we need umbrellas. Yeah. Has to be a thing. Yeah.
With the dirt.
Yeah.
No, I just think as people, as humans, we all talk about birth and we celebrate birth. And I know that's the good bit. We just don't talk about death at all. And I think certainly from my point of view, moving forward, we shall. Yeah. We'll talk about death more.
Well, I think we as a family have been so incredibly lucky that this is one of, you know, certainly in my memory, one of the only kind of really bad things to happen to me. And so the discussion of death never really came up all that much growing up because we were lucky enough to not have to experience it firsthand. Mm. And maybe it's, like, as you say, better to discuss it prior to it happening for the first time.
Well, it's an inevitable thing. The only thing that's guaranteed that every single one of us has in common is that we're all going to die. And yet we don't go there at all. Because it might happen if we talk about it.
What have you got on the question list?
Next one I've got is, what is your trick to raise great humans?
Oh, that's a good question.
If I could sing, I'd sing it. To me, as a single word, is respect. So I think, and I would certainly drag your dad in here because he had a very strong influence on my early parenting. Because I thought kids were supposed to be wild and run around like crazy idiots. And we had some friends over one day and he was like, no, they're not. That's not how they're supposed to be. And so we had respectful relationships. And that didn't mean that I was a friend. I was a parent, but in a very respectful way. I always joke that I spent a lot of all of your younger years sitting on the laundry floor with you discussing why you're in timeout and what we could do to make sure you didn't get back here again. So that's what I think it is. It's just respect, love and respect, mutual.
It helps, I think, if the humans in question are just, you know, individually brilliant.
Well, awesome humans. That's a good point, actually. Yeah. I mean, how the hell can you raise awesome humans if you don't start with awesome humans? And I did start with three awesome humans.
Good genetics.
Mm. My next one is, what is the number one thing you want to do to honour Nicole moving forward?
Oh, there's not one, there's a million. But the one that's the most pressing right now is to organise the book because we have got, I don't know, 5 books worth of notes.
There's and, so much content.
There's so much content. Yeah. And I think that it stalled because Nicole, you know, was so sick really for the last 12 months, even though that wasn't the face she put on Instagram necessarily. But I think that would be the beautiful thing to do would be to get that book published because there's a lot of people that want to read it too, I think, including me.
Yeah. And me. And also, I mean, if it's on tape, let's be we'll get. Maybe you could.
Yeah, you can read
a voice.
Yeah, I know you could do that because then you'd have to read it in order to say it.
There's a way to guarantee
force you into it.
Guarantee Sean reads a book.
And you couldn't say no, I'm not doing that because it would be for Nicole. Yeah, so you'd be kind of
or just read it halfway through, like with most things. Yeah, I've done the majority of it.
People would download the book and it just stopped halfway. Like, is that the to the end.
My final question from the people. When did you realize that things were going downhill?
With Nicole, in terms of her death, the day before she died. I think it's important to note here that Nicole didn't die of cancer. Am I allowed to note that at this point?
Yeah, I was going to ask you it, but let's get into it. Yeah.
Okay.
What happened?
Nicole was admitted to hospital on Boxing Day with a cough, a chest infection, effectively is what you would call it. And so Christmas Day, she'd been pretty lie down on the couch but still participated, but she was very clearly not great on Christmas Day. And on Boxing Day, I took her to hospital. Tim went off to his Cooper Christmas because that was their turn. And Nicole was fine, really. She had a chest infection. She wasn't well. She had a bit of a fever, you know, all those things you have with an infection. But then, very rapidly it became apparent that she had pneumonia and Nicole had a good lung and a really, really not good lung. And whenever she'd had pneumonia before, it had always been in the bad lung, but this time it got into the good lung. So she basically had her good lung full of pneumonia, and her bad lung was just not capable of carrying her in terms of oxygen. Mm. So, we were battling and we were fighting. We were doing a typical, you know, Nicole goes into hospital, Nicole fights and she gets better and we bring her home again. And so really it wasn't apparent how bad it was until the day before she died.
Mm.
So, yeah, that was pretty horrific. And I think a lot of people were very, very shocked, including all of us, really.
Yeah, I mean, you guys, you and Tim spent a lot of time in hospital in those sort of 2 and a bit weeks. Mm. We were all at home trying to carry on with life as usual, knowing that you guys were there telling to her that she wasn't well. Mm. But I don't think there was any indication to any of us that it was that bad until day before, right? Mm.
Like, and I don't think it was with you know, we were all in the same boat, really. Yeah. I mean, sure, Tim and I had much more idea how much she was struggling and how much she was battling and what she was battling and the extent to which she could not survive at all without really high flow oxygen. But she, you know, she was Nicole. She laughed. I remember the day before, so the day we realized it was so bad. Like you say, Tim and I stayed the whole time at the mm-hmm. hospital the last 4 or 5 days, and Tim had spent the first half of the night in her room with her on a chair, and I'd gone off to the bed, and then we would swap. And so I came in at around 3 or 3.30, and she stirred and she looked at me. Remember, this is 3.30 in the morning, and she's on high-flow oxygen in an ICU unit, and she looked at me and she said, "Oh, my God, you must be so tired. Have you had any sleep at all?" And how do you respond to that? Come on, man, you're the guy in the ICU bed on high flow oxygen. Why are you worrying about me? But that was Nicole.
Classic Nicole.
Classic Nicole.
Yeah. You, as a part of, I gave you homework.
Mm-hmm.
And as a part of discussions leading up to this, I wanted to know sort of in numbers about Nicole's treatment. So I think one of the things that, and we'll get into this chat a bit maybe. One of the things that maybe plagued Nicole is that she always looked well. She never looked as sick as she was.
No.
And I think, and you and I talked about this recently, Mum, if you look back sort of, you know, 6 months photos, you can spot that she was sick.
Well, we can spot, but I don't think other people would spot at the time we didn't spot. You know what I mean? Like it's easy in retrospect to go back and go, actually, hang on a minute. I can see a turning point here, and I can remember being in a place where she couldn't climb a set of stairs or couldn't walk a kilometer or we had to walk really slowly because she couldn't keep up. And so all those things at the time are just in the moment and you don't add them all up until later. And then when you look back, you go, hang on a minute.
Have you got a list for us?
I have. So I think it's really important to put like a time frame around this. So Nicole was diagnosed in March 2017 and she died in January 2023. So that was 5 years and 10 months. And in that 5 years and 10 months, she had 13 lots of major surgery. So that included bowel resection, a couple of liver resections, a lot of lung resections, removal of a rib. Like she had a lot of surgery, 13 separate surgeries. She had over 70 rounds of heavy chemotherapy. She had 70 rounds of heavy chemotherapy. And I don't know how many months there are in 5 years and 10 months, but like pretty much means she was on.
I'm not particularly good at time.
Where's Tim? Where's Matt?
5 12s is.
Where's Tim? Where's Josh?
What about?
She had over 30 rounds of immunotherapy. She had well over 100 scans. She had over 300 blood tests. And then she had 2 blocks of radiotherapy, one of which went over about a 5 week period where she had to go every single day for radiotherapy over 5 weeks, excluding weekends. And then she had another one, September, October, where that was another 5 days of radiotherapy. So, I mean, what was it we were talking about? What stages she'd been off treatment or how long she spent off treatment?
Yeah, in talking with Prasad, ex-guest of the Impatient Podcast, he told me that she had a period between May of 2020, immediately post-surgery, where we thought we'd got it all. We thought we were disease-free. And November of 2020, when we found more disease, where she was not on active treatment. And that's the only period in those five and a bit years.
So that's basically 6 months out of 5 years and 10 months.
Yeah, but it's 6 months through the peak of COVID.
Yes, well, that's right. Yeah, because she couldn't travel. I remember her saying that. Like, yeah. I'm finding a place where I could go anywhere and do anything.
And I can't.
And I can't go anywhere or do anything. Because we lived in Melbourne too, keeping in mind that Melbourne was the most locked down city on the planet.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she was locked at home for those 6 months when she could have done anything.
Rough.
So, yeah, that was her lot. And I think that when you consider that amount of treatments over that sort of really intense time frame, you can see that she couldn't possibly have been as well as she appeared. That's not possible for her to have done that, So, but she was always very determined in everything she did, and that included, you know, how can you be a patient advocate? How can you work to help other people if you don't look good or act good yourself? So, yeah, she was always determined to look better.
She, I think it's probably fair to say that a lot of people would describe her as strong. And you were talking about that wasn't necessarily always the case.
No, it wasn't, no. Well, it was actually, somebody said to me, I've got to read these words because I can't see without glasses. Trauma doesn't build character. Trauma doesn't build resilience. Trauma reveals character and resilience. Mm. And that was really quite enlightening for me, because when we talk about Nicole being strong, yeah, she wasn't always. Like I was saying this week, like if I really stop and think about Nicole before she had cancer, like if you had to describe her in a single word in terms of how brave was she, she was a wuss. Like she was a real full-blown wuss, yeah? So she was. She didn't like pain at all. So if you would, Nicole would never go to the doctors by herself. If she had to go for a blood test, I would go with her. We discovered when she was about 12 that you actually had to get her to lie down when she had a blood test because she would faint otherwise. So she wasn't a brave person at all. She wasn't a strong person. I think the turning point in terms of her bravery or self-belief maybe was having Joshua, because I think going through childbirth was an extraordinary experience for both her and Tim, as it is for most parents. But I think she was empowered by that I mean, her labor was something ridiculous, like 36 hours or something. She was in like heavy labor. And she just pushed on and pushed on and pushed on, as you do. But she almost found this inner strength from that point. And remembering that Joshua was only 8 months old when she was diagnosed with cancer. So she was busy being a mum. She had so much to live for. She was busy building that resilience in herself. And you know, her only symptoms were tiredness. Like that was literally all she had.
Yeah.
And there's a sense of guilt in me that I push aside and go, no, I couldn't have done any more than I did. But as a young mum, calling her mum, i.e. me, and telling me how terribly, terribly tired she was, I was almost dismissive. Like, hey, Nicole, like you've got an eight-month-old baby, you're working, you're breastfeeding, he doesn't sleep at all. Of course you're tired. Like, what do you expect to be? And she, again, was so determined that she said, no, hang on, there's got to be more to it than this. And she went off and pursued, as we know, and discovered that she had stage 4 bowel cancer. Mm. So, but she wasn't always externally strong.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, like in terms of like career pathways.
Hugely strong.
But yeah, and I think she's always been that.
Mm.
Like so almost brave is the word I want to use. Mm. Like did stuff that I would never consider touching with a barge pole. And I don't know to what extent we're allowed to talk about that stuff. I'm not sure.
Well, that's in the book, so
It'll come out in the book. Buy the book, everybody.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it feels like a question you'd see on a BuzzFeed article, but if you had to choose, or if you could tell us about some key moments in the past 5 years that you think are the kind of pinnacle.
Can pinnacle be bad as well as good?
The key pinnacle worst moments, I guess. Not to be a downer.
I think like pinnacle's up. What's down? Like the bottomicle.
The downicle.
I mean, clearly the very first one is when you first get the news, yeah? So we'd been away in the States and we'd come back and I had like landed in Perth and pretty much turned around and got on a plane and came here because Nicole was tired, in inverted commas. And so I'd been here the week before and spent the weekend with her and then I'd gone back to Perth and then she eventually got her doctor's appointment and she went for a scan, CT, MRI, I don't remember, not with MRI. She went for a scan, ultrasound. And they noticed lesions in her liver and then it was quite messy that afternoon in terms of trying to figure out what was going on. But we got a call to say, oh, it's okay, it's just all sort of benign stuff post-pregnancy. And then a couple of hours later we got another call to say, well, no, actually not, it's cancer. And so that came from absolutely nowhere. Like talk about a freight train hitting you, because it came from nowhere.
And they called to say it was cancer?
Nicole called us.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so Nicole and Tim were called in. So basically the gastroenterologist called Nicole and said, I know that you were here. I need you to come here.
Yeah,
come
here I remember right now. That. Yeah. Yeah, you have to come in.
I need you to not bring your baby. Yeah. I need you to bring your husband. And then, yes, so Nicole did all that and then called us. We're in Perth. And to give, I mean, I'm sure that anybody gets that call. It's horrific. It's going to be. But to add some perspective and further to the sort of the stuff we don't talk about in our family sort of thing, nobody in my family on either side had had cancer. I knew nothing at all about cancer. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know what chemotherapy was. I didn't know how you treat stuff. I didn't know about stages. I didn't know anything at all. But we got on a plane and came here on the midnight flight on Jetstar, which is the only time I've ever flown Jetstar in my entire life.
The thing that I'm shocked about here is that you got here flying Jetstar and they didn't cancel your flight.
Well, that's true. They did, yeah.
This has happened to Liam.
Yes.
Just yesterday.
Just yesterday.
That's got to be the first one, yeah. The second one that jumps to my head is, you know, visiting with Prasad for the very first time and him saying like there was this kind of minor chance, like a minuscule chance that if he threw everything that he had in his chemo bag at Nicole, that possibly she could become her liver could become operable. And like there's heaps in between there because obviously then there's the first bit where you get the diagnosis and the prognosis of you've got 18 months to live and then there's you go get the second opinion. The second opinion says, well, actually if we throw everything at it, well, maybe we can get you to a point where you can have surgery. And maybe to clarify, the reason that they only gave her 18 months to live is that her liver had so many tumors in it that her liver was not going to be able to function. Mm. So the second big kind of marker for me was we were in Port Hedland of all places, Peter and I, doing some real estate training up there on a pre-planned trip. There was no way we could get out of it. And I think it was July. So we'd got March, April, May, June, July when we got the call to say that they'd done the scan and the tumors were shrinking like crazy and it was very clear that her liver was going to become operable. And I can remember the exact point where I was when I got that piece of news.
Mm. I remember that phone call and I remember exactly where I was.
Beautiful, yeah. So I don't know that. How many do you want?
I want to go back to your first meeting with Prasad.
Yep.
Because just to make the story clear, she had been told by an oncologist that she was not treatable.
Correct.
They said 18 months, 2 years.
And they would give her
palliative care.
Thank you. Yeah, palliative chemotherapy, yeah.
Just to help make her comfortable.
Yeah.
But that she would be dead in 2 years. Mm. You sought a second opinion through somebody who knew of?
Yeah, somebody who knew somebody and got us in to see a liver surgeon.
Okay.
Yep.
And he recommended?
Well, he'd seen the scans. So when he got to the liver surgeon, he'd already seen the scans. Mm-hmm. And this is only a week after she's been diagnosed, yeah?
Yeah.
he looked at the scans and he said, I would like you, you know, he said, you're in a terrible situation, like your liver here is in a really bad way, but I would like you to, if you're happy, to speak to an oncologist who I do a lot of work with. And while we were sitting in his office, he called Prasad, and Prasad agreed to see us that afternoon. So we got in our car and then we drove out to see Prasad. And it was interesting because Prasad's office has, it's a little, like an old house, a cute little old house that's been made into an office, clearly. And it has a white picket fence out the front. And I think all of us have this memory of driving down this little street and approaching this beautiful little cottage with a white picket fence and big trees in the yard and having this sense of almost, I don't know, joy, serenity. It just had this beautiful vibe, yeah. And then Prasad, and he was the most calm, measured, amazing human being. And he did this thing with his fingers where he said there's this tiny window of opportunity, and he made like the little square with his forefinger and his thumb, this tiny, tiny window of opportunity. And we clung to that. We so clung to that. And that made her so determined to just go in and go, yeah, well, if there's a 1% chance that I might live, 1% is enough. Yeah. That's enough for me to hang on to.
Yeah. So I assume you all left that meeting going, yeah, okay, he's the guy.
Oh, we made the decision he was the guy in his room. Like we said to him, you're a guy. Like that decision was made. Funny story that I remember in the car afterwards. So we got back in the car and I think it was Greg and Cheryl. So Greg and Cheryl, as in Tim's parents, Greg was driving and Cheryl was in the front and Nicole and I were in the back is my memory. And Nicole's biggest stress, her biggest concern was, well, now I have to sack my first oncologist. Like she was like, who's making that call? And I said, I'm making that call. Give me your phone. Let's get me the number. I'll make that call right now. And I remember where I was when I made that call too. Oh. Thank you for your service. It's no longer required. We're moving on. We found a window.
But I think that's funny because I think Nicole further down the line would have had a lot less trouble making that call.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's interesting actually because she got a bit of spiciness about her.
Spicy is a good word.
But I think developed over, years of stuff going wrong and challenges and battles and How long from when you left Prasad's office till Nicole's first treatment?
Because
the thing that's going through my head here is this is stage 4 cancer. Time is money.
And so part of her discussion with Prasad on that very first day was, I am booked up. My memory tells me it was a Tuesday, and I may be wrong, but this is like time frame. My memory tells me it was a Tuesday, and she was booked to have her port installed into her chest. So the port is the thing that delivers chemo into the body. And that was booked to be done on the Thursday. And she literally said to him, I'm not cancelling that appointment. I'm getting this port put in on Thursday. Yeah. So, unless you can get it. And he went, no, it's fine. You go and get, because that was done through the other hospital and the other team. But yeah, she still went and got that done. And then he commenced treatment immediately, I don't know, within two, three days. Like she was so determined, I'm happy to swap to you, but you ain't no pushing me back. Like we're sticking to the original plan of when my treatments start. Yeah, she always was very vocal.
The beginning
vocal
of the spiciness.
Yes, I think of it as almost a sassiness.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I may look, I don't know, petite and polite, but if you mess with me,
you'll find
you're going to know about it.
Yeah. Tenacity.
Yeah. Determination.
I was chatting with Prasad and he told me that the initial run of treatment for Nicole was 6 months in blocks, right? 3-month blocks. And we scanned after the first three. And that was the good news phone call.
That was when they said, that was a good news phone call, But
the treatment that she was on in those 6 months were in, as he described, in solid cancer land. Mm. I've learned that there are cancers that are not solid this week. That's my education. Liam's looking at me like, oh, boy. That was the look I just got. This guy, I don't know about him.
You want to have a podcast?
In solid cancer land, the treatment that she was given for the first 6 months is the harshest treatment that there is. Mm. It's full-blown chemotherapy, as bad as it gets. And I remember vividly, and I have a lot of photographs and a lot of very fond memories of exercising with Nicole, because Prasad prescribed, it's a word I can't say, there aren't many. I mean, well, there's countless if you include other languages, but in English.
He was adamant about exercise.
He was adamant, thank you, that she exercised and as part of her treatment.
Correct.
So we used to go, it was winter, we used to go to the park, like at the back of her house, and do like workouts in the park. But she was getting issues from the cold.
She had the peripheral neuropathy,
so because of the chemotherapy.
So she used to wear massive gloves, like doing exercise in the park. Yeah.
But was so driven, like just to the most remarkable level. Which was kind of almost intoxicating to be around. And I found it quite motivating personally. Because that was,
as did I,
the period of my life where I was the most fit I've ever been, because I was like, I don't want to exercise today, but also Nicole is, and
it's pretty piss poor if I don't.
It reflects poorly, right? Like, yeah.
But I remember the physical transformation that she went through was not one of, you know, going from, you know, quote unquote healthy to not to, to looking like a cancer patient. She went from being what she was to packing on muscle and losing a lot of weight
and getting,
but in a kind of healthier,
like getting really fit.
Can I just add to that? Like when you're talking about exercise and how driven she was and how you would think to yourself, oh, I can't be bothered. Oh yeah, I will. Cause she is. I would also say that the same applied to your mood. Like if ever you were feeling like a bit blue or a bit fed up or a bit, she would bounce into the room because she bounced everywhere and you'd go, oh, we're good. We're good. We're great. We're having, we're all, and you would find this incredible energy.
But that was her.
That's one of the things I miss them, like a lot, every day I miss that. I miss that kind of, that energy that would just, I'm going to say walk in the room because it didn't walk in the room, it bounced in the room.
But it also dragged us all through those bad news moments, right? Yeah. She was always the one that was, okay, today's cancer-related news is pretty shit.
Yeah, it's not great.
But guess what? Yeah, we're going. We're doing what we need to do to push through that, where the rest of, I don't want to speak for you, but I was like, oh, man, this is relentless. Mm. Like it doesn't stop. And she is just, the train's leaving. Get on board, man. Like we're not doing that bit. Yeah. We're not doing that. Get on.
Relentless is a really good word, because if you add up like 13 surgeries, 70 rounds of chemo, it was relentless. Like there was never a week where you weren't doing something, and sometimes you were doing something every single day of the week. And it was relentless. But she didn't, she always bounced back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was, I wrote down a thing, I was chatting with Prasad, as I've said 47,000 times already. He said part of Nicole's grace was her mindset around this stuff. He said that she had said, when you're doing really hard stuff, things go wrong. And she accepted that wholeheartedly and was always the first person to move on to, you know, rather than dwelling on what's next. Mm. Like the surgery in 2020, the one where we thought we got it. Mm. The one we thought we'd won, and then they discovered some cancer on her skin after the fact. Mm. And we'd gone from we are disease free to we are fighting the battle like full on the front line again, like overnight. She was as relentless as the disease was in her fight against it, right? Like she was remarkable.
She was. Can I do a segue here to something else when you just use the word graceful?
Go on.
Today I was driving Joshua and he was making this click, click noise with his tongue, like click, click, click with his tongue. And it was driving me crazy because I have a problem with noises. And so, I tried a couple of times saying don't click, and that was clearly not working because he was still clicking. So I said to him, I have an idea. Why don't we think of adjectives that describe mama? And so he immediately came up with kind, and he came up with two or three. And I said, I've got an idea. Let's start with A and let's go through the entire alphabet. Mm-hmm. And he did it beautifully. But his word for G was graceful.
Oh, really?
Which I thought was quite a remarkable word. And you've just used it and said Prasad used it.
That's beautiful.
I think great. Yeah, I think it's just like a kind of not a word you would expect from a 6.5-year-old child, really, to describe his mom. She was graceful. But, yeah, that was a fun exercise.
He does do a lot of things that you wouldn't expect from a 6.5-year-old, if I'm honest. Is there anything that you wanted to talk about?
There's a million things, but there's not a particular thing. I think a lot of people talk about, you know, my relationship with her. Which was an astounding relationship. Obviously, as like I said, based on respect. But I think a commitment that I made to myself very early on. I don't know if I can do this. Don't know if I can say this, but I made a commitment to myself internally that I would never have any regret, and so. The reason that I pushed so hard, the reason that I showed up to chemo after chemo, the reason that I flew backwards and forwards across the country trying to work, and was that I had to be there for every single thing where she might need me. And on the day she died, I actually sat by myself and contemplated whether I had any regrets or whether I could have done anything differently, and I didn't. And that was a warm feeling for me, was that she was astounding. She was resilient. She was the strongest person I've ever met in my entire life. But I felt like I did everything I could have done to support her. I couldn't think of one single thing that I would have done differently if I had the chance to do it again. So that was nice for me.
I don't think that anybody close to her would have any objection whatsoever to that idea. I don't think that anybody that wasn't close to her, that just followed her story, would feel any different. Yeah. I think that it's fairly universally understood that if there was a Mum of the Year award, it would probably go to Nicole, but then maybe you would be runner-up and that would be nice for you.
Exactly.
That would be you get to stand in the back and watch her get the award.
Yeah. Be good. Stand next to her on the podium. Yeah.
She would be Mum of the Year.
The other thing I kind of want to talk about is what can other newly diagnosed and even not newly diagnosed, just any patient dealing with tricky situations, what do you reckon they can most learn from Nicole's story or Nicole's experience?
I think you have to question a lot, question people, question processes. I think based on what she and Tim did, and they were a team, they were an absolute team, but they learned so much. And I didn't, I did, but not from a medical point of view, yeah? Mm. So Nicole and Tim made it their business to understand everything that was going on, to the point where very often they would meet people and talk to people. And I was with Nicole on many occasions in hospitals and medical situations where people who didn't know her would say, "Are you from a medical background?" Like she went over the top to learn things, as did Tim, and not all of us have the ability or the wherewithal to do that. But I would say question things, ask questions, don't just accept. Because if Nicole had accepted her original prognosis of 18 months, then we wouldn't be sitting here now, you know, 6 years later. This would have been a story that was very old by now. Mm. I think there's a lot of in the space now of, you know, the medical system. There's a lot of people questioning the system. There's a lot of people questioning what bits of the system are not working. You're seeing that almost daily now in news reports. And it's, you know, it's not limited to to locations. You see it in rural areas and regional areas. You see it in cities. You know, there's an investigation into this death or that death and whether it was appropriate. There's a lot of people questioning stuff, and I just think that, the more that people do question stuff, and ideally question it before you're dealing with a death, not afterwards, you know, be prepared to make a lot of loud noise. And Nicole was very good at making other people like her. She had an absolute talent for that, whereas I am more abrasive. I don't know whether you've ever noticed that. And in fairness, you two take after me. So.
I wouldn't have described you as abrasive. I think you're quite charming.
Bit of a Brillo pad. But Nicole was not.
Just fine sandpaper.
Fine.
like a 300 grit.
Yeah. Is it? High grit count.
Now, Nicole was the fine sandpaper that followed me around.
Sorry about that.
You know, whatever. That's who I am. So, yeah, she had an amazing ability to communicate what needed to be communicated without, you know, like putting her hands on him and saying, well, let me tell you what. She was very, very good at that, incredibly diplomatic.
Mm.
But, yeah, question stuff. That was a really long answer to a short question.
No, but it could be longer though, right?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Look, it's just scraping the sides of...
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Of the importance of asking questions. All right. You got anything? All right. You got anything?
I do have something.
Go on.
I do have something.
Oh, sorry, we're out of time.
Well, my understanding of your podcast, having listened to, you know, all of them, is that you have a patient bit and then you have the advocacy, or not the advocacy bit, but the experty bit. And I thought that it would be really nice to just talk about a couple of the things that she did in her advocacy space. I don't know. Do you want to do that, or is that?
Yeah, I do. It's great.
I just smacked the microphone.
Smacked the audience. Right.
Just like a real quick, like, whiz through, just because we kind of put this list together after Nicole died by going back through all sorts of different things and trying to compile a list. So she was an ambassador for Bowel Cancer Australia from the time she was diagnosed in 2017 through to 2022. She was a board member on a colorectal cancer audit. Mm-hmm. The first patient ever to be a board member in that type of situation, which I thought was astounding.
Mm.
And keeping in mind that she did that during 2021, 2022, which was probably really, really tough for her, tough times.
Yeah.
And in spite of what she was going through, or despite what she was going through, she just kind of soldiered on and did all these things.
Mm.
She worked in numerous kind of government advisory committees. She, in 2018, she was the face of COSA, which is the Clinical Oncology Society of Australia. They made their statement on exercise and cancer, and she was the face of that statement, and that was that whole thing of exercise should be prescribed as an adjunct therapy to chemotherapy. And she was on the front page of the newspaper, and she was interviewed on television. Mm. You know, she did all of these different things whilst also having all of those surgeries and chemotherapies and all those treatments. And I think it's really important that people realise the extent to which she kept doing this work in spite of her own physical situation. She never let her illness get on top of what
never got in the way.
She needed to communicate some stuff, and she made sure she did it. Yeah.
Yeah.
She worked with Epworth, the hospital that did all of her treatments and where most of her surgery occurred. They opened a new wing to their hospital last year, and that wing contains a gym for cancer patients. And that was something that she pushed hard, really, really hard for, to make sure that actually happened.
Mm.
I could turn the page and there's more.
There's more, please.
But wait, there's more. She worked with Melbourne University the actual title, Associate Investigator, Contributing Research and Delivering Curriculum Design. She starred in, you would remember back in 2007, the Taboo, the TV show, mm-hmm. Taboo,
yeah.
Where she appeared. That was subjects that were taboo to talk about, and that was about having a terminal diagnosis in terms of an illness, and she appeared on that.
Yeah, which if you haven't watched, you should track down.
Mm. Yeah. So good.
It was a very good watch.
Yeah, I like there's the, I honestly can go on and on and on. There are just so many different things, and a lot of people I think just saw her as, you know, having a bit of a voice and a following on Instagram, but really all she did was use that Instagram platform to raise her profile, that so she was better able to do the other things. Yeah.
Yeah, so she could get stuff done.
Yeah.
These are Nicole's questions. I'm going to ask them of you.
Oh.
I haven't told you that I'm going to do this.
No.
Because I'm excited to see what you come up with off the cuff.
Gulp.
We would like to know from you something in our healthcare system that is working, something that is broken, and something that the whole system needs to hear.
Four. I got to tell you that the working bit is hard. I really, as an Australian in 2023, what's working in the healthcare system, I think, is really a difficult question to answer. Can I skip that one and come back?
Sure.
The second question was, what's broken?
Something that's broken.
I guess I've just got to, you know, jump on Nicole's bandwagon here and say patients categorically are not at the center of the vast majority of decisions that are made in the healthcare system. They simply are not. The patient is like an add-on thought after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you try to get an appointment with a GP now because you're sick today, you'll be lucky to get one in the next 7 days.
Mm.
And when people are sick, GP type sick, you know, something's happened and I'm really sick right now. Who's got 7 days to wait? I don't. Mm. You know, the public system, if you want to, you know, if you've got a problem, you have to go on a waiting list. And then if you want a second opinion, you go back on the waiting list to get your second opinion. Like all of that sort of stuff is so broken.
Mm.
And
something the whole system needs to hear.
It's 2023. And we need to move on from the archaic way of thinking that dictates everything that's done in the medical system. We're stuck in the past, from how doctors qualify to get into courses to become doctors, to a doctor's belief and many hospitals' beliefs, and not all doctors and not all hospitals, but many who believe that they are, you know, right up there close to God, and the patients need to continue to worship them the way they did back in the 1800s. Like, you know, it's time to move on. It's time to embrace the humanity of medicine and go back to focusing on the people that are sick and how to get them better.
Well said.
Did you want to go back to what might be maybe not good but okay? Is there anything that's okay?
We have a medical system. That's good. Yeah. A lot of countries don't have. Look, I'm struggling. I really am. I'm sorry.
We had a previous patient, and I can't remember who it is off the top of my head, and I'm so sorry. I think it might be Susanna, who had what I think is my favorite answer to this question. And that is, that individuals can make such a profound difference to the lives of a patient.
Yeah.
Which I think is a really important thing for anyone that works in healthcare to understand.
Okay, can I change my answer then now?
Sure, go. could you tell us something in the healthcare system that's working?
Yes. There are individuals. But it's true, yeah. Like I don't. When I'm thinking like the system, I'm not thinking at a level of. But there are certain, and we've certainly come across some profound individuals who make a profound difference, and they do it on a daily basis.
Mm.
But they're not the norm. They're the one in a million. To me, you know what I mean. There are, and certainly there are people who've, you know, Nicole's been privileged to be treated by, who are different. But even those people, like when you go into the second bit, they struggle to do what they do because the system doesn't let them do what they do. Then it's more broken than it is good. So, but yes, well done to those individuals. Yay, go you.
I've got a hint of sarcasm.
I did say I was abrasive. Now you.
Very balanced opinion, really.
You need to be the fine grit sandpaper that smooths that all out and makes it nice.
Well, the challenge here is, I mean, the people don't know Liam that well yet. They'll get to know him. He's the calmer one of the two of us.
Less abrasive is what you're saying.
Yeah. he's going to have to step into the – because Nicole, when we used to prep for podcasts, I would go, the system stinks, and go on these long rants, and Nicole would go, yep, okay, but we just need to just smooth out the edges on how we might get that across in sort of a diplomatic way.
What my colleague means to say.
Well, Liam's going to be stepping into that position.
Look, you've really sold it.
Good luck.
Yeah, that's. I'm looking forward to it.
Good. Thank you, Mumsy. I would like, actually, this is probably the most important thing we need to talk about today, is I don't call you Mumsy.
No.
Nicole called you Mumsy. Mm. I'm going to put an end to Mumsy right now, I think.
That might not be a popular.
Well, no, okay. We'll continue to do it on the gram, as the people in the biz call it. Mm. But I always call you Ma.
I know you do. Mm. And can I just say that from my point of view, thrilled. Mumsy's just soft and nice. I'm out of Ma.
Yeah. Ma.
And Liam calls me Jack because he works with me.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And he gets embarrassed in a work situation going, Mom. So I'm Mumsy, Ma,
excuse me,
Jack.
Mother.
Ma. Okay, hey, Mumsy. Thank you for doing this, for speaking to the people.
Thank you.
I greatly appreciate it. I'm assuming Liam does.
I would like to say thank you to the people for the questions.
Good.
And also for dealing with some of our technical problems that we've had.
A few people have stuck with us. We love you, people.
We love
thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for sharing with me. Clearly, this was always going to be an emotional issue. But we did it. We got there.
Hmm. And thanks to the... the cheap seats.
Studio audience.
Yeah. Let's go drink some champagne.
Let's.
Cheers. Cheerio. To Nicole.
To Nicole.
To Nicole.
Come on, man. Empty glass. It's always the way.
And with that is what I've been told, I have to say. Actually, it's not even my words. But that was the chat with Mumsy. Just, you know, a brief chat, you could say.
Yeah.
Because there was obviously a lot that kind of went unsaid.
Timing restrictions. The next program's going to come on and something.
Exactly, mm. Yeah. And, you know, maybe we'll talk to Mumsy again.
Oh, okay. I like that.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, though, not filmed.
No. Yeah, that was unfortunate. We did, you know, we do mean to film everything going forward, but we just had some, you know, some technical difficulties.
I don't want to say that I was the technical difficulty, but I do want to say that you technically do work in IT, so I feel like you probably should resolve my problems.
Well, technically you can be a bit difficult sometimes, so yeah.
We also didn't have an expert on this episode. Unusual format for us, but, you know, unusual circumstances too.
Definitely.
So stick with us. We've got lots coming.
I would like to say a massive thank you to the people, both for their contributions and also for their questions. I think the questions were fantastic and really added a nice little aspect to the potty there.
Yeah, and also their ongoing support just... generally, right? Like the support we've had on social media has been a little bit, dare I say, overwhelming, but in a positive way. It's been quite nice.
Positively overwhelming.
Positively overwhelming. So thank you.
Absolutely. And I think in saying that, we should also kind of say thank you for the ongoing contributions. And if you have been in touch... we haven't forgotten you. Please don't feel like we have.
Yeah, no, well, I do feel like we've been saying this for the last 6 to 12 months. We haven't forgotten you.
No.
Please do keep reaching out if you'd like to be involved. If you have reached out and you are waiting for a response, just wait longer.
You know,
no, we're coming.
Reach out again. You know?
Yeah, like, no, that's a good
really
point.
Harass Sean into listening to you, I think is generally the way to get things done.
Well said.
I was about to say, the next thing I have written down here is that I want to thank Brother Liam for contributing. Well, now I'm not so sure. So maybe we'll just call it a day. See you next time.
Bye.